Bougainvillein with a title about the impossibility of ever to leave the Earth's gravitational field. And I attended this, and he brought the well-known proof that when you take 1 kilogram of the best-known propellants, let's say alcohol and hydrogen and oxygen or so, put them together, the calories which you get out of the reaction is, per kilogram is less than what you need in order to put this kilogram up to the satellite speed. And certainly, that is correct, only the conclusions which you draw were completely incorrect. You do not put up the kilogram of fuel with which you start on the button. No, no. All up to... all up here. That was a big, big error in this calculation, certainly, which nobody realized, because nobody gave him this answer. And, of course, second one, that he did not consider the principle of staging, which is basically the same principle. Now, I had, of course, when I was after my doctoral degree for 4 more years at Professor L. Schiller, S-C-H-I-L-L-E-R, at Leipzig, where I worked on about 10 different doctoral dissertations, different people. And when I told this to Professor Schiller that I had been in Berlin and attending that talk and meeting, he said, Doctor, don't waste your time. Has no sense to talk about leaving the Earth's gravitational field or not before we not know exactly the drag coefficient of slender bodies, projectiles, at supersonic speed. That was a very correct, typical scientific answer, and he was certainly correct. And one important aspect, and so I kept this in my mind. Very briefly after that time, I left Leipzig and went to Aachen, A-A-C-H-E-N, Technische Hochschule, where there was the Aachen, famous aerodynamic institute, which von Karman had founded. But von Karman at this time was already at the United States, because this was in end of 1937, this was in 1933. And I went there because I felt with my interests that I could accommodate this better at the Technical Hochschule than at the university, because I was really interested in application of principles. And I was there only about 6 months, when suddenly the head of the Aerodynamic Institute, Professor Wieselsberger, W-I-E-S-E-L-S-B-E-R-G-E-R, when he came to me and asked me if I would be interested to stay longer at the Institute and to develop a supersonic wind tunnel.
What applications did he have in mind?
Yes, as a number one, it was very unusual because they did not exist any supersonic wind tunnel anywhere of a kind. Only in Göttingen, Brandl had a very tiny one with one Mach number, 1.4 Mach number, while this was the application that's very interesting. Everybody thought we should go from after we covered the subsonic, we at this time just barely approached into the compressible range. The first transonic wind tunnels were under construction, but not in operation. We had the feeling we should cover supersonic, but of course we had to find a reason. And it's interesting that always people try to find the reasons, and afterwards, it's completely different. I mean, there are others. I think this is a very important principle which everybody should watch when doing development. So, a reason was brought up, the development of cascades for gas turbines, which run run at supersonic speeds, at least they can, things, and nothing is known about the supersonic flow around airfoils and particular cascades of airfoils with a complicated flow through the passages. And that was considered as a kind, let's say, a peacetime application. The other one, which was also mentioned, was projectiles for the army ordnance. Because the ballistics was well developed in Berlin by, for instance, Professor Kranz, C-R-A-N-Z, and Becker, one of his students, who became then later chief of the army ordnance for many time, and he had particular interest in Peenemünde and also took very strong interest in the development of a supersonic wind tunnel and also a artillery firing tunnel. Which I will mention later. So, the army ordnance knew only by firing tests, by reduction of the results of firing tests, what the aerodynamic forces acting on projectiles of such and such shapes and rotating, which makes it very difficult, would be. Now, the supersonic wind tunnel would be the first time means to determine this step by step with all the variables separated. Yeah. This offer was in October 1933, and it was to start about half a year later in March 34. The wind tunnel was financed by a contract through the Air Force. It took me about 2 years to design, calculate, to design, build the tunnel, which was a 10 centimeter by 10 centimeter cross section. From the beginning should cover a large Mach number range from Mach number 1.2, just above transonic, and up to 3.3 right at the beginning, and they were all developed simultaneously. And as a very important thing, to develop at the same time a three-component balance which would measure electromagnetically the forces, lift, drag, and pitching moment, three components. That had never been done in supersonics before. In Aachen, they had a one-component balance with weights on. Also just built according to the old subsonic wind tunnels parallel. Professor Winkelsberger put particular emphasis on the development of the balance. He was a great combination of a scientist and an engineer down to the design and the final hardware. I also hired at this time another engineer with whom I worked then for maybe 9 years together. For 12 years together, from 34 to the end of the war, Hans Gessner, G-E-S-S-N-E-R. He never came to this country, unfortunately, even tried after the war. He assisted me or put into hardware my ideas about the supersonic wind tunnels at Aachen and then later at Peenemünde and later at Kochel for the hypersonic wind tunnels. Just going back to 1933 at Leipzig, the first really scientific, technically written book on rocketry was this by Eugene Senger, Die Raketentechnik, I believe is the title, and it was given to me by the Journal of Physics in order that I would write a review on this book. And I don't have the review anymore, but I remember that in the beginning, I said, that is the first really scientifically written book in the area of rocketry. That was Physikalische Zeitschrift, 1933.
We'll look it up.
Now going back to Aachen, started the supersonic wind tunnel in April 1934 and worked on it 1935, 1936 started, and it was had already made several runs. The balance was not ready, but the Schlieren, we saw the first with Schlieren, beautiful Schlieren equipment we had built. We could see the details of the flow at angles of attack of projectiles and wings. On the 6th of January 1936 was the most important date for me, for the future technical development of my life. At Aachen Institute of Technology, we certainly had announced a visit of three gentlemen from Berlin, and Professor Michelsberger kept in conference with them in his own office without my participation. Later, he came out to me and talked and said, there are three gentlemen here, one from the Army Ordnance and one Professor Busemann, famous already whom I knew from the as a university professor, and a representative of the Air Force, because we worked on our supersonic wind tunnel on Air Force contract, so he was certainly there. And I would be shown, he said, before we entered, certain drawings of body shapes, and I would be asked if that could be measured in the wind tunnel, at what speed, at what sizes, how long it would take. And I should not ask questions for what purpose that body was. This was before any formal establishment of a secret clearance. When I went in the room, I found Dr. Van Braun presented to me, a very young boy, I saw the drawing was painted cigar-shaped, tapered at the end, and a little fins at the end. And the main thing, the aft body was no aft aerodynamic afterbody, but it was cut off straight at the base. When I saw this, I knew immediately that must be rocket-powered, but of course I couldn't ask questions. Then they showed me, of course, the figures were without any numbers on, so I could not see the size or anything, and although they indicated that it would be very interested in reaching whatever Mach number I could obtain. I said I had up to Mach, from Mach number 1.2 to up to Mach number 3.34 nozzles. Supersonic nozzles available for experimentation. It would last until the summer, until I would have the first, the balance in correct shape, but under this time I could do flow pictures, and from the flow pictures already find out many things. The representative of the Air Force was Dr. Lorenz, L-O-R-E-N-Z. This was not a professor, mm-hmm. and a young man, we would call him maybe one of the younger echelons, but he had received a PhD formally in engineering from Aachen and was at the same time at the Air Force about contracting research.
What was your impression of von Braun, just personally, when you first met him?
Very fascinating, certainly, immediately inspiring, and
what did he say? What could he talk about? I mean, he was showing me these shapes.
He showed me the shapes and asked me this, and also showed me a calculated trajectory which led up to altitudes of maybe 40-50 kilometers. and speeds up to 1,000 meters per second, roughly Mach number 3. And I saw this on the trajectory calculation. So, but it was a projectile, was of course clear, and but nothing about any propulsion, rocket propulsion, which was very secret. Nobody was permitted to talk. We agreed certainly that I could make the required measurements and investigations, and that immediately starting with the flow pictures for the construction of the models and the flow pictures, and that around July 1 I could produce then the data, the forces, lift, pitch and moment. After a few weeks, I got invited to come to Berlin and talk there. I met at this time, the first time, Walter Bernberger.
Was it Kummersdorf?
No, that was in Berlin, mm-hmm. in the office, also in the Army Ordnance office building. And I was very much impressed by Bernberger immediately. And he asked his typical questions, very precise, and how long it would take. And
was that? Do you remember how many months after January 36th?
That was about April 34. April 36, and of course I wrote the usual report when you work on contract for the government, and also a few months later, about June or July 36, I was again in Berlin and brought the first results of the force measurements, which showed, very important, that the fins proposed by the Army Ordnance for that rocket were much too small and for supersonic speeds would not produce stability. That means when fired without internal tests, they would have been complete failure by tumbling.
By tumbling.
This time, Bernberger informed me, yes, with Brown, about that this was a rocket, and I was in August or September 34, my first visit invited to Kummersdorf. And in Kummersdorf, I saw the first time some of Van Braun's associates. Otto Rudolph and others. Also was tremendously impressed by the actually size, that was the E3, which were worked about 60 centimeter diameter. No, dimensions are known of the E3. And was permitted to attend an actual rocket test, still very primitive, standing behind trees, just taking color, and that was a burning test of at least 40 seconds of run successful. Was of great importance that everybody who worked there were of great enthusiasm, and this enthusiasm also spread to me, and worked like mad on the changing of different fin assemblies in Aachen in order to find one which would be stable up to Mach number 3. And we finally developed things like this in, I would say, fall 36 was it. The next big step was in October, roughly October the 5th or so, 1936, when I was at Berlin, and Bernberger And Van Braun told me that they were in the process of preparing or to develop, to build the rocket experiment station at Peenemünde, which, of course, nobody ever heard about this small village. And that Dornberger wanted to have a supersonic wind tunnel there with much larger capabilities, higher speeds, larger size for bigger models, and then the Aachen, which was more built for research. He asked me if I could, from the morning, our meeting, till 5 o'clock in the afternoon, present a proposal of such a wind tunnel, how large it would look, how it would work, and how much it would cost. Because at 5 o'clock in the evening, they had another meeting where they wanted to defend the budget to get the also Dornberger in awe that such a tunnel could be used not only for the rocket development, but also for the benefit of all the army ordnance projectiles and the anti-aircraft projectiles, particularly because they had to be of high power, high speed, higher speed than before, and they had great difficulties in raising the speed and still being stable. So he foresaw this, and he also got the support of this department chief, which was not under Dornberger, which was parallel to him, and which helped probably to convince General Becker this time to approve the project. So between 9 o'clock in the morning until 6 o'clock at the same day, the whole project was proposed and approved.
Hmm. So I don't have my doubt anymore.
And this is how you can do development.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I said it was never considered that by the Army that they would, say, subcontract to the or contract with the Air Force tunnel or supported tunnel at Aachen, the same way that, say, we might, Army might, and did do work up here at Tullahoma on occasion.
No, this was not considered because of many things. Number one, the tunnel should be much larger and faster and operate with many people in order to really give results quick. And a university-type atmosphere was not the right thing for this. Mm. Also, of course, the secrecy which was involved in this thing would have been very difficult to do at the university, at least in this nature.
So the university at Aachen, what was that called again?
That was the Technische Hochschule Aachen, the Aerodynamische Institut.
Okay.
Das Aerodynamische Institut. Mm-hmm. One word about my proposal from the morning hour to the 5 o'clock, I moved to a cafe in Berlin in the corner and worked there with slide rule and several telephone calls to Aachen, worked out the dimensions necessary, the equipment, and got my first estimate for the supersonic wind tunnel with 300,000 mark. It turned out later, of course, that it cost about 800,000 or 900,000, but that nobody could foresee that at this time. Many years later, that was established as the real cost. Also, Dornberger, a few weeks later, made me an offer to join Van Braun at Peenemünde, and so he had to give up my university career, which I had started with a lot of work, hard work.
This would have been in October 36.
The offer was made in October 36 and 4 April 1, 1937.
That's when you reported for duty.
Yes. I accepted. Turned out that after a few weeks, when this was known, because I had to tell this, of course, when this was known to the Air Force, Department of the Air Force, that they tried everything to keep me for the new supersonic wind tunnels facilities to be built at Braunschweig by the Air Force, which was later on the Luftfahrtforschungsanstalt Hermann Göring in Braunschweig. But and made it clear to the Air Force that the rocket problem which was involved at Peenemünde and Associated was much more challenging for me, so I decided to go to the Army Ordnance to Peenemünde. On April 1, 1937, I reported for duty there, together with about 20 people which I had hired in the meantime.
So you didn't take them from your own institute?
A few of them, yes. Uh-huh. I took this Mr. Hans Gessner, whom I mentioned before, as my chief design engineer with me. And as mentioned before, he was paramount or his essential that he put to very, very detailed engineering work and design and manufacturing, that it really worked.
When you went to Peenemünde, what was your official title and position and organization did you work?
Yeah, the, it was called the Heeresversuchsanstalt Peenemünde. Peenemünde itself was divided into two, and in A and B, to say so, and the Heeresversuchsstelle was the portion A, and then was on the same area, only about 5 kilometers away, was the Air Force Station, which was built as a large, tremendously large airfield with hangars for the investigation of rocket assistant takeoff, large bombers, etc., which is known, and also the later the Messerschmitt two rocket, first rocket airplanes were developed and flown from this airfield. So we had close contact with those engineers because we lived with them in the same government housing project and knew the pilots flying there. And of course, later then also was the V-1 developed at that.
Did you have an institute or a division that you ran?
My division, Van Braun, was the technical director of Peenemünde, and I was one of the maybe five divisions or departments, and my department was called simple Root Canal, with the abbreviation symbol WK. The WK was found in many documents, archives carry this symbol WK. Mm-hmm. And Van Braun reported in Peenemünde in the first year to a general, which was not later Dornberger or Sanson, was Schneider, S-C-H-N-E-I-D-E-R, who was in old-time artillery, out of the artillery development coming general, who was very conservative with the standards, our standards, on Braun. And Dornberger at this time was at Berlin at the Army Ordnance, to say so, directing from there all the efforts. It turned out that we got great difficulties in operation, and with this general, who was very old-fashioned and couldn't understand our fast working and trips necessary made all over Germany, universities, and after hard fighting, then finally the general was moved to another post, and from then on we got either Dornberger or Sanson, who, as you know, alternately were either commandant of Peenemünde one, and the other at the same time was the division chief at Berlin Army Ordnance, and after 1 year or two, they switched those. From there on, then, of course, it was great and all under one, really one direction. You asked about the organizational structure, which I described, and it took less than a year, maybe 6, 7, or 8 months, that Bernberger suggested a new organization. It was called then Werk Ost, was the, and Werk West. Werk West was it. The Air Force, Werk Ost was the Army, and in Werk Ost was von Braun called, I believe, Referat 1, and I was Referat 2. And I reported not to Braun anymore, but directly to the commanding General Bernberger of Sansen or at Berlin. The reason for this was that, of course, already at this time, not only the rocket work, but also the need for the ballistic work on the projectiles, which I mentioned, was appealing. I started with a staff of 20, which I had hired before coming there, and grew up to maybe 50 or 60 people, and in the first 2 years, before that was still peacetime, 1937, 8, and up to the spring of 39. We had built a supersonic wind tunnel with a cross-section 40 centimeter by 40 centimeter, which had 16 times the cross-section of the Aachen tunnel. Also, with large capacity vacuum tanks, 1,000 cubic meter, and with 6 vacuum compressors, with a total of 1,000 kW. We built simultaneously also already, there was a provision made for a second test section because we anticipated more and more work and wanted one test section was ready to do the needed work, wanted to do in the second test section developmental or research work needed to increase our Mach numbers. We reached after 2 years, we had nozzles, Laval nozzles of Mach number 1.2, 1.4, 1.86, 2.24, and 2.8, and 3.34. We tried Mach number 4 to reach, of actually 4.3, and that was the first time when it took longer than we had expected. And it turned out that it was just when you have the high Mach numbers, it means you have in the nozzle very low pressures because we operated only with 1 atmosphere stagnation pressure, because we considered the atmosphere is important to being a big reservoir of very constant conditions. We're afraid to have a tank ahead, which during the run, of course, loses pressure and loses temperature by adiabatic expansion, which involves many, many new problems which you don't want to solve if you don't know the other ones, or if you have first to solve your main problems. This means that Mach number 4, the static pressure in the test section was maybe of the order of 1 millimeter mercury, 1 torr, and that means a vacuum. And we had difficulties with the ceiling, that everywhere, our big windows, the air moved in addition, and that meant the wind tunnel operated actually as an as an air injector, drawing air in, and certainly we could not reach Mach 4 at all. Once it was recognized that it was a ceiling, and all design efforts were put on this, we reached it right away, and that was then about at the end of 1939. The large three component balance also was ready in fall 39. Just when the war started. A very important step in the development of the Peenemünde was actually December 37, when the first four units of the A-3 rocket were launched at the island of... no, I'll find the name later. I'll say Oi, O-I-E, Oi, which means island, Oi, just about 8 kilometers off the shore. And those three, which we had, of course, aerodynamically developed, and they all failed. They all started with the engine, but after reaching between 500 or 1,000 meter altitude, they all coughed. And when they were in horizontal position, the parachute came out. As was supposed to be, but of course in much, much higher altitude, and then the parachute entangled the whole thing, burned fire, and they came down and exploded. All four did the same thing, roughly, launched within 2 or 3 weeks prior to Christmas, and we went home, everybody extremely discouraged. And over the Christmas holidays, I discussed this with the head of the Applied Mathematics and Gas Dynamics branch, Dr. Willy Haldai, H-E-Y-B-E-Y, who later came to the United States, and then also for Navy Ordnance Lab, and then to Marshall Space Flight Center, up to his retirement a year ago. And I brought him the idea one should try first, in order everybody discussed what would that be the reason for this mishap, that didn't work or this not work. I brought up the idea we should make a calculation point by point, fraction of a second, in let's say 1/5 or 1/10 of a second interval, assuming everything would work exactly as planned. But including the strong side wind, which we had, natural wind, which we had during the launching, which were up to 25, 30 or more meters per second, a very heavy wind. I told Bernbauer before the launching that I would disadvise against launching, I would advise against launching because of the strong wind. And I told him that even aircraft, new developed aircraft, even they fly since 1904, and it was 1937, every new aircraft was very carefully evaluated at wind, still weather, etc. And here was the first time in history a rocket flying in a storm so that we had hard time to walk. He said, Doctor, we do not develop a nice weather weapon. That was Bernbauer, and of course the lines that went on, and that was, they resulted in the failure. I still was convinced it had to do with the wind, and I had observed that all four had gone in the trajectory against the wind. I could at this time to the military not make clear that a rocket then stable must go into the wind, because everything else, including the artillery projectiles, they are blown away from the wind by natural wind. As aerodynamicists, that is obviously, but that's still hard to make clear. And the fact that they all four went exactly into the wind instead of vertical, as they should, indicated that the wind was an important thing. So we made a calculation. Haldai responded with tremendous interest, and we put on immediately all people we had, and with hand calculators, and for maybe a week or so, and could show that with the wind, with the aerodynamics, that it is stable, as we measured in the wind tunnel, that it had to go to the wind, that the railways, if they were correct, took so much time to respond, that they took so much time, ran on the potential motor to produce so many waves, and they produced on electric motor the movement of the rudders, those were the rudders in the jet, and of course it takes time that they run from 0 to 5 or 10 or 15 degrees, and then they produce a moment and again the wind moment, and only from then on you counteract the wind. And when this happens, so many seconds are passed, or 2-3 seconds, that the rocket has already a direction away from the vertical so large that no mechanism which we had built it could ever move the rocket up again. Now, we proved this exactly point for point in course, and Popper's, I remember, in the week after Christmas, to von Braun and Mitterby to Dornberger, so we thought we knew really what the reason was. If it was a strong wind, and if the wind would have been much less, it would have worked. And otherwise, they all worked exactly as designed. Nobody at this time had ever made, prior to a flight, a complete flight by mathematics or computers, or which of course didn't exist, or analog computers. We had to do this. Once we knew this, then of course we could also find out what to change. The sensitivity of the control mechanism had to be much faster, and the speed of running out of the rudders much faster. Also, they had to be bigger so that the final moment they could establish in the jet would be about 5 times as much, and the speed was about 10 times as faster as we had originally. And that, of course, needed about 2 years to go through all the design concepts, calculations, and build. And it was only in 1949 that the first one, which we called A5, it was improved A3, a little bit enlarged, plus all this. And that one way flew, and the first time also completely vertical, and after they showed this, then a programmed turn into the direction which was desired. But that was in 1939. Besides the development of the wind tunnel, which went up to Mach 4.4, the 40 by 30 centimeter, we got very definite plans of what we called later a hypersonic tunnel, Hyperschall in Germany, H-Y-P-E-R, the Greek word, in contrast to the Überschall, the supersonic. The reason for this was when the United States of America ended in the war against Germany in the beginning of December 1941, about 1 week later, I wrote a 2-page letter to the Army Ordnance proposing that hypersonic wind tunnel up to Mach number 10 should be built in order to develop the upper stages of, let's say, 2-stage missiles, which had to fly with these velocities, Mach 10, in order to cross the Atlantic Ocean. And the development, the size and development time, power, etc., was sketched in this short letter. This was the in the half year afterwards, up to the summer 42, were made more detailed investigations about, although the need for the use of federal water hydroelectric power, because during the war it was impossible to build somewhere in Germany certainly an installation which would need roughly 70,000 kilowatts. In June 43, Dornberger gave us the official go-ahead on the definite planning and assigned the necessary construction people to to us. From summer 42 to the summer of 43, we spent this year investigating, making many trips with representatives of Minister Speer, who wrote the book recently, because it was under his ministry that also all the water power and the electric power was under his resort. So with one of his deputies made the trips to Austria, of the Alps there, to find places, and finally ended also through Tyrol, and finally ended up the most
important